Welcome to the 21st Century HR Podcast. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt. In today's episode, we are going to be taking a closer look at the LinkedIn Gender Diversity Report. There's some interesting statistics in that, and we're going to dig into that a little bit deeper. So we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify is a boutique agency that provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services to help companies modernize their recruiting and employer branding capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem is designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com.
Welcome to the 21st Century HR Podcast. In today's episode, we are going to be taking a closer look at LinkedIn's recently released Gender Insights Report. I'm not going to go over the entire report and break everything down. I will include a link to it in the show description so you can peruse that at your own convenience. But I do want to highlight a couple things that stood out, I think are key takeaways in recruiting and talent that we should be thinking about. So just to open things up, 71% of talent professionals report that achieving gender parity is a top priority for them. I'm surprised that wasn't actually a little bit higher. This is a global data set, so I think there's over 20 countries represented. I think a sample size of over 7,000 LinkedIn members. So, you know, fairly small, but still somewhat representative, at least globally. And I think that's their opening stat. It kind of sets the expectation for how talent leaders are thinking about gender parity in their organization. And then throughout the survey, they look at a variety of elements in terms of how people review and engage with content and job descriptions and look at that from a gender split perspective. So the first thing I want to get into is something that to me reinforced something that I've been thinking for a while, which is this whole myth of passive talent. Right? In recruiting, we get so enamored with passive talent as if it is a 10x multiplier of impact above active talent. And we build entire recruiting processes around passive talent. And to me, I think especially at this day and age where we have so many different tools at our disposal to reach talent and to attract them and to influence them, to me, whether you're active or passive, is irrelevant. And frankly, it can change on a weekly basis, an hourly basis, in some cases a daily basis, right? If you get somebody with the right message at the right time, with the right content, you're gonna get their attention. And so 90% of both men and women, this is a balanced number across both genders, are open to hearing about new opportunities. And on average, in 2018, LinkedIn members viewed 45 jobs. So when you think about this, there's really no point in trying to differentiate a talent strategy around active and passive talent. The way that you're going to be able to attract and ultimately retain them will certainly be personalized. That doesn't mean one size fits all, but it does mean to me that this idea that, you know, passive talent is this rare and unique beast is kind of blown up. Now, if 90% of people are open to hearing about job opportunities, that's pretty much everybody. So again, I think that they've got some data that reinforced a view certainly that I've seen anecdotally that that was something that stood out to me. You know, another element that was really reinforced is one of the problems that we have with one of the most, most used, most longstanding and least evolved tools that we have in recruiting, which is the job description. You know, most job descriptions are retreads of the last time you hired somebody. They're overly dense. They're unrealistic in terms of responsibilities and qualifications. And they don't do a great job of really telling a story around an opportunity and ultimately through that attracting the right talent. But there's more problems that the LinkedIn survey and LinkedIn report illuminated. For one, women are 16% less likely to apply to the same job as men. Two, women apply to 20% fewer jobs than men. Why is that? There's a real issue with women essentially screening themselves out of jobs. According to LinkedIn's data, women feel they need to meet 100% of the stated criteria to apply to a job. Men need 60%. That's a massive delta. And it's underscored by the fact that we're so good at writing crappy job descriptions, right? That are overly dense, they're overly, full of unrealistic requirements. And if that 100% figure bears through, you're only going to get super fully baked candidates who are women even considering applying your job. And that's a huge problem. And so I think, how do you address this, right? What are some things that you can do to write job descriptions that are more likely to attract a more representative pool of talent? And there's a couple things to consider. You know, there's lots of great tools out there like Textio and others that will help you kind of audit the language that you use in your job description to make it more gender neutral, you know, and or even skew towards a particular gender. So you can tweak the language, and I think that there's great tools that can help you do that. But more importantly, I think that what this really means is that the recruiters have to do a better job when they're sitting with their hiring managers in scoping meetings and working on the spec, working on the requirement, to push back and to ask hard questions. And a lot of times, you know, look, let's face it, hiring managers, by the time you're getting ready to hire somebody, most of them probably, you know, wanted and or needed that person several months ago. So they're already kind of operating in the deficit. They know that it's going to take weeks to months to hire that person. And by that time, they're like, oh my God, you know, we're going to be so far behind. This project's going to be delayed. I need to have somebody coming in with all of these skills so they can make up for that lost time. And if they're not getting any pushback from their recruiter and they go to market with that kind of a spec, obviously this data, you know, gives you a sense of what that talent pool is going to look like. So, you know, recruiters, we all need to do a better job when we're sitting with those hiring managers is to really, you know, ask the questions and point by point. Do they really need X years of experience? Do they really need to have gone to this school? Do they really need this certificate? You know, will they be able to do the job effectively if they did not have those things, right? Those are the kind of questions that we need to be having so that we can really make sure that we're not overbaking a job description so much that it's limiting our candidate pool. And another element, so one of the interesting takeaways from the report was that they did a survey of men and women asking them, what are the five most important things for them to see in a job description? And number one was the thing that we most often neglect to include in a job description, which is salary and compensation data. And when you think about it, I've struggled with this for a long time as a practitioner. You know, I've led global recruiting teams at a variety of companies, and I've always been an advocate for including comp range data in job specs. And you know, I typically get pushback from that, and it comes from a couple places. I think in some cases, organizations are, you know, back in the day, right? Like back in the day, people would have ranges for a role. Most comps have a range. But companies would also try to get candidates in at the lowest end of that range as they can. And so they had objections to the idea of including a comp range of saying, well, if my comp range is 70 to 100 and you are making 65, I don't want you to see that our comp can go up to 100, right? Then you might want 100 and you're not worth that. As if they're not capable of having a reasoned conversation with a candidate about that very fact. They just say, oh, somebody might think that, so let's just not do it at all. And you know, that creates some real issues. I think the other kind of legacy driver of that is that some companies are really kind of scared to talk openly about comp ranges and salaries internally. So there's a fear of if we include a comp range on this role, then other people in other departments might see that and question why that role would make that kind of money, you know, as if, again, they're not dealing with adults and they can't include kind of market data around this is what comp is, this is what market is for this given role. But those were kind of legacy hurdles, if you will, to trying to be transparent and open around compensation. I think we've grown past that. I think it's time that we can move forward. And having a range, when you think about it, having a range on a job description is going to make your recruiting much more effective. If you have a role that is comped in the 70 to 100K range, and a candidate, and I don't really care what you're making, and legally you can't ask what they're making, obviously, in several states. If you're looking for 150 and my job maxes out at 100, I want you to know that and I want you to not apply, right? If that's a key driver for you, I want you to understand that so that I'm not wasting your time, you're not wasting my time. And so I think having those comp ranges up front allows candidates to make more informed decisions and opt in or out. And I think that that is really important. So another element that is really important to consider is branding. So one of the things that the report illuminates as well is that, and this was actually balanced across genders, 42% of men and 41% of women research a company on LinkedIn before applying for a job. And when you think about this, you know, LinkedIn, that means they're going to go to your company page, but that means they're also going to go to your LinkedIn Life page. And LinkedIn Life, for all of you LinkedIn branding natives that are listening, it is a page that they created a couple years ago that is allows you to create a kind of customized view of the organization and the culture. And you can upload media, you can upload videos, you can include in testimonials for employees. If you have employees that are using the LinkedIn publishing platform, you can embed those directly on your page. But it gives another layer of depth and context to your organization that, from an employer branding standpoint, is really valuable, because that's, you know, for most organizations, LinkedIn's one of the top, if not the top, recruiting asset they're using. And I think a lot of people don't, you know, if they don't know about the LinkedIn Life page, if you haven't had recruiters, or if you haven't had branding resources to actually build that out, you know, some companies are blank, and that's a real issue. If I'm a job seeker and I'm trying to learn about your company and you don't have a Life page, and I'm going to other companies and they all do, I mean, I wonder a bit about, okay, well, what are you doing? Is there something you don't want to tell me? Is there something that you're trying to, hide? Or are you not sophisticated enough to include some information? I think for SMBs, you might struggle with the idea of investing. So you can spend a lot of money on LinkedIn pages. You can create multiple pages that are regional and or functional and have different languages. And they use a cookie-based tracking system. And they have member data, obviously. So if I have 5 LinkedIn Life pages for 5 regions, and I'm a job seeker in EMEA, it's going to know that, and it's going to serve me up your EMEA page, so I can get personalized content. So yes, you can do that. You can get crazy sophisticated and really kind of in depth on the branding side, but you also don't have to do that. Most companies, or all companies, for free, you can go and create a basic Life page. So at a minimum, I would do that, because again, almost half of job seekers are checking those pages out when they're applying to you through LinkedIn. So anyway, a couple key takeaways for me. I definitely encourage you to read the report. I'll include a link to that in the show notes. So thanks for listening, and we will see you next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast library just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you're enjoying this podcast, help me get the word out. Share it with your friends, your family, your neighbors, your coworkers, and anybody that might want to learn a little bit more about what HR can do when done really well. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.